I remember that song. Did that band record any other song? Wonder what else is on that album. Wonder what other songs of theirs are good. Wonder why only one hit.
Loyal listener, you know at the end of our last Wonder Why episode, I said we'd be reviewing the Gentrys, but we called an audible, and we're actually doing the Vapors. And so what you just heard was the classic 1980 top 40 hit, Turning Japanese. We'll get more into that in a minute, but let's get the introductions out of the way. This is Wonder Why. I am one of your hosts, Chad Smart. You can find me on Twitter, at Chad Smart. Across the Skype line is our resident musical expert here at the Positive Cynicism Podcasting Network, the hashtag PCPN. It's Mike DeKalb. Mike, did you turn Japanese or were you, I don't even remember what the Gentry song was supposed to be, so I've got nothing to play off of.
Yeah, I mean, that was your selection, so I never heard it before you talked about it, and as soon as you changed to the Vapors, I blocked it right back out of my mind. So, but no, I never turned Japanese. I'll tell you a quick story. I almost moved to Japan, though. Does that count for something? My dad was in the Navy, and in 1985, we were living north of Chicago, and my dad's, his ticket was up, kind of a thing, where they're like, okay, you've done 4 years here, now you're going to move on to somewhere else. And so they gave us the option to go to Japan, and we were actually looking into it, and we brought materials home to study. We were like, okay, you got to take your shoes off when you enter the house. And then at the very last minute, there was like three guys, and they had to deploy them to different places. And one of the guys had just come from Hawaii, and they had to send someone to Hawaii. So he's like, I don't want to go there. And they were like, hey, Mr. DeKalb, do you want to go to Hawaii? And so he's like, let me talk to my family. And he came home and said, hey, instead of Japan, you want to go to Hawaii, kids? Like, yes, yeah, we'll do that. We'll do that instead.
Yeah.
So I almost moved to a place in Japan called Yokosuka, which apparently was like some sort of a U.S. naval base.
All right.
So I would have turned Japanese at that time. That would have been 5 years after the song had come out.
I was going to say, did the preparations for moving to Japan tell you what to do in case of a giant lizard coming out of the water and trampling your city?
Sadly, no. Yeah, uh-huh. It would have just been run around with your arms flailing wildly, probably.
Yeah. And I'm glad you took the turning Japanese and went in a whole other direction instead of what the song is allegedly about, which
yeah.
I'm sure we'll get into later on. But first, this is The Vapors that we're going to be talking about, a British new wave band from the late 70s, early 80s. And a little spoiler alert, I'm glad we switched from the Gentrys to The Vapors. And I think you, loyal listener at home, will enjoy it as well. So, Mike, why don't we start off? Can you give us some backstory as to who the Vapors are?
Well, I mean, like I said, they're just one of those post-punk, new wave kind of bands. Like, it's weird. They kind of bridge the gap between the two, and I think we'll get into it, and that might have explained why they only had one hit, because they were sort of a hybrid of all these different styles that would have been coming out of England in the late 70s. Plus, I mean, you would have had the new wave of British heavy metal, right? You would have had Judas Priest and Iron Maiden and Diamond Head and all them coming out. So, yeah, as you said, they basically formed in 1978. Their front man, the guy we're going to be basically talking about for most of the episode, his name was Dave Fenton. And I read that, you know, he had started as an acoustic folk artist, you know, just him and a guitar. And he mentions how he gravitated to punk music when it became popular. And I don't know if you saw this in your research as well, but I thought it was absolutely fascinating that Dave Fenton actually worked in law. Like he was in a law practice. And so he wanted to take a break to pursue music, but he was a little worried because he read that, you know, or he knew that it would be very difficult if he wanted to take time off, because he'd have to, you can't just take too much time off from the law practice because you have to be retrained if you go back. I have to go back to it. And so as he tells the story, that he went to his parents and said, I'm going to take 1 year off and then I'm going to go back to it. And nothing happens in that 1 year, then I'll go back to working as a lawyer. And everything blew up that 1 year, you know, so it worked out really well for him. He mentioned how, I guess at that time, you can only imagine what it would have been like with the amount of bands that were popping up, with so many different musical genres blowing, you know, getting huge in the late 70s in England. And he said that several different bands had broken up at the same time. And so he was able to just cherry pick musicians to be in this group, you know. And what I thought was really funny was he formed the group in 1978. But by the time they break through in 1979, he's the only member of the band that's still there. You know, and even when the band got discovered, between the time they got discovered and the time they signed a record label, the band had changed as well, you know. And so that's just kind of the basic backstory. Something we always talk about here on Wonder Why a lot, that I always bring up, is what I like to call the Svengali. Like there's some sort of like a producer or somebody helps them get their big break or writes their songs or something. And in this situation, there's a very talented musician by the name of Bruce Foxton. And he is the bass player for a fantastic band called The Jam. And, you know, if you don't know much about The Jam, they were like a mix of like you could tell they were inspired by like the early music of The Who, that sort of mod where they would wear suits and stuff, like full on suits. But then they were sort of, it was kind of like a reaction to the punk. Like, cause I think a lot of people what I've read is that not everyone was into punk. Like punk was really big, but then once it got so big, then people thought that punk musicians were just kind of like, you know, that image, it didn't really work. So the people liked the music. So they're trying to figure out that's why you see a lot of times bands are lumped into this category, which you call post-punk, because it's sort of like, well, we like the music and the aggression, but we don't necessarily do the image. And so The Jam was like, okay, we're going to be clean cut looking guys dressed like mods from the 60s. But we're going to play this awesome sort of punk edged music, and it's great. Yeah. And so Bruce Foxton's the bass player. He goes to an early show from the Vapors when they're just playing around in clubs to like, I think I saw, so they were playing in clubs and like 20 people would show up, and he just happened to catch them. And as soon as he saw them, he really liked them, and he agreed to co-manage the band and he was going to manage them with a guy named John Weller. John Weller's son, Paul. Paul Weller is the front man of The Jam, the incredibly talented front man of The Jam. And so what I thought was even more fascinating was that he, at that point, Bruce Foxton offers the Vapors the chance to open for The Jam on a tour. They had an album coming out that was called Setting Suns. And so the Vapors were going to open for The Jam on that tour. Like they hadn't even put anything together. So yeah, so then at that point, they've got to pick a record label, right? And so they have a choice between two record labels, which was, the first one was Polydor, which was The Jam's record label. And then there was also United Artists. I forget this. You remember this, Chad? United Artists had a record label. They were not just a movie studio. Mm-hmm. And they were trying to branch out. And of course, unfortunately, the movie studio was going belly up around that time. That's when Heaven's Gate came out and bankrupted the movie studio. And so United Artists Records, well, the head of press for United Artists Records was Bruce Foxton's girlfriend. So they had basically had two choices, and they didn't really want to be in The Jam's shadow. They had already got them to kind of give them their big break. They were going to open for them on tour, and they didn't want it to seem like the only reason they got signed was because of The Jam's influence, you know. So instead, they signed to United Artists Records, and that was in 1979. And it reminded me a lot. You ever heard the story about one of my favorite filmmakers is Robert Zemeckis, and he always talks about how like his first two movies were produced by Steven Spielberg, and they both bombed. And he had another movie called Back to the Future, and Spielberg was like, I want to produce it. And he was like, no, I got to make this on my own. I don't want people to think that I'm only getting movies made because I know Steven Spielberg. And so he went almost 4 years without working because he was trying to get something done. And then he finally was able to be a director for hire on Romancing the Stone. That was a huge hit. And he went back to Spielberg and said, okay, let's do Back to the Future. And so it kind of reminded me of like you said before we went on the air, you were going to listen to some of the Jam. Again, I cannot recommend them enough. They are fantastic. And it just seems like that they're so connected to the Vapors. Because of the connections with the band, they toured together. I think their sound is a little bit similar. I think the Vapors are a little bit more poppy. They don't have that sort of punk aggressive edge that the Jam does. But yeah, and so I think that's where they're at. They drop a single, and did you read like Turning Japanese? They were sure it was going to be a hit, and so they specifically said, well, let's make it our second single because we don't want to be a one-hit wonder. So let's make it our second single. So they dropped their first single, which is a song called Prisoners. I listen to that, and it's okay. I'm prisoner number one. I won't get parole because I carry a gun. I'm prisoner number one. I'm prisoner number one. We're all prisoners. We're all prisoners. We're all prisoners here. And that song failed the chart. So then by the time their second single comes out, it blows up, and then that's their big hit. So, but I don't know if from that point on, I mean, I don't know if we can look at the charts. I mean, this is back in an era, you know, we talk about it on this show. We like to look at the album that the song came on. Well, I'm always fascinated by when I see bands drop a single before they've ever dropped an album. And then it's like, well, the single blows up. And you're like, well, now we got to construct an album around it, right? I think we had that with M and Pop Music. You know, a lot of other bands like that, where the single comes out first, it gets a lot of traction, and then they got to find some way to put an album together. And I think they put a pretty good album together as well. I mean, as far as that goes. So, what have you got? Are we going to shift over to the song Turning Japanese now, or what do you want to do?
Well, I want to talk the Jam just real quick, because I did listen to some of their stuff when I started my research and found their connection there. I know the name, the Jam, but I couldn't tell you anything about them. And yeah, I think there is a very similar sound between the two bands, and I'm sure, you know, when we get into their post career, we'll bring up the Jam again because there is more of a connection later on. But yeah, we can go to the charts because, well, that's what we do here on the show. And well, one other thing that I was going to mention is it's interesting to me in the 31 episodes that I believe we've done of this show so far. We now actually have a repeat of sorts in this song because much like Kung Fu Fighting, the Carl Douglas film, there is a very famous riff in Turning Japanese, which is known as the, you know, by the Oriental Riff. Yeah, it's so cleverly Oriental named. That's just there. And I just find that interesting that you incorporate this into, you know, a lot of songs. I'm surprised when Avril Lavigne came out with a song a few years ago that had a Japanese theme. I'm surprised it's not in there because it just seems like that's what you do when you're talking about a Japanese culture. So
yeah, I mean, it's funny because I mean, I don't know if you heard. If you go on YouTube, you can find there's a demo version of the song that was uploaded by the original guitar player that was replaced before they got big. And the Oriental Riff is only at the beginning, like because in the finished version it plays a little bit throughout the song, maybe on some of the pre-chorus or the pre-verse kind of stuff, or in the bridge. But I did think that was kind of interesting. We were like, oh yeah, that's that same riff that you kind of hear from on Kung Fu Fighting. Yeah, I forgot to ask before we get to the charts. Do you remember the first time you heard this, like your first exposure to the song?
I don't remember my first time because when the song came out, I would have been 5-6 years old, but I remember this song, and it's not one of the songs that immediately jumped out to me as a candidate for this, you know, the series that we do on One Hit Wonders. But I know of the song. I like the song, but it's just it's not, you know, I think, and I didn't look to see if there's a, you know, like where it ranks on VH1's top 100 One Hit Wonders, but
yeah, it's on there, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm actually going to look it up as I'm talking about the charts. We talk about the charts, but yeah, I mean, it is a song that I remember hearing back in the day, and then, you know, by being a one hit wonder and the career that the Vapors had, like, it's again, it's I'm sure it's probably on compilation CDs that may have had, but and I'm sure we'll.
Well, I don't remember, like, what I found so funny is I talk about on the show all the time that we had MTV almost from day one. And I mean, I guess I remember it being on, I guess I remember being on at some point, but what I thought was funny, I didn't realize it came out in 1980, you know? And I mean, the song even predates MTV. Mm-hmm. So they made a music video, which made me wonder, like, where was it airing? Like, I read that there was an HBO used to do a music video showcase, and that's where it was on. So it's funny to think about how, like, if it was 1980, but yet I don't remember it being, I can remember hearing it in 1983 or 84, you know, and that video, maybe MTV needed videos to show at that time. Mm-hmm. But I feel like I give them credit. It's for 40 years on, and it's still something you hear all the time, whether it be on the radio. It's in a lot of movie soundtracks, and, you know, and so I give them credit for the longevity of it in that respect. Yeah.
And just for the record, for people playing along at home, according to VH1, it is the 29th best one-hit wonder. Being sandwiched between Don't Worry, Be Happy, which is a song I think we've said we'll probably never cover on this show, and Our House, coming in at 28 by the band Madness.
Of course.
But anyway, that's VH1's charts. Let's turn over to the Billboard charts to see where this song, that I'm kind of surprised that it only reached the heights that it did. I thought it would have been bigger, but, you know, it's the charts at the time. So let's go hop in that Wayback Machine and travel all the way back to the fall of 1980. As we record this, just over 40 years ago. Damn, we're old. So, the week of September 27th, 1980, Turning Japanese hits the charts at number 86. And then it spends the next month and a half basically climbing slowly up the charts. And it cracks the top 40 at number 38 the weekend of November 15th. So, here are 31 through 40. Mike, put on your musical knowledge hat where you test your knowledge to see if you know these songs. And I'm curious, being 1980, there are some obvious ones in here and some that you could have spotted me every vowel and four out of the five you know what I'm trying to say. And it would not have gotten it. So here we go. The week of November 15th, 1980. The number 40 song was I Believe in You.
I Believe in You. Okay, no.
That's Don Williams.
Oh, okay.
39 is If You Should Sail.
Oh, God. No.
It's not Styx. They're not the ones sailing. It's not Christopher Cross or whoever else had a sailing song.
Yeah.
And it's also not the long-haired blonde twins Nelson. It is Nielsen.
Okay.
Number 38 is Turning Japanese by the Vapors. 37 is It's My Turn.
No, got nothing.
Diana Ross.
Okay.
Number 36, Sometimes a Fantasy.
Oh, that's Billy Joel, right?
That is Billy Joel, yeah. I don't know if I know that song.
I heard that song, you know, again, when the lockdown started, I was doing a lot of projects around the house, and I would always have like a radio, one of those internet radio stations playing in the background, and I guess that was like Billy Joel's attempt at like a new wave sound. And I remember this song would pop up on a lot of these 80s stations because I wasn't overly familiar with it. It's a really good song. It's not necessarily one of the bigger hits that you recognize, but it's a fun song, and it's him trying to adapt to the musical trends that were going from the 70s into the 80s. So yeah, that's a good one.
Number 35 is Every Woman in the World.
Every woman in the world to me. Is that Air Supply?
That's Air Supply.
Okay.
Number 34 is This Time.
This Time? No.
It's The Coug, John Cougar. No Mellencamp.
Okay. Early Coug.
Yeah. 33 is Jesse?
No.
Carly Simon.
Okay.
32 is Everybody's Got to Learn Sometime.
Nope.
That is The Corgis. You know The Corgis?
Sure.
And the number 31 song for the weekend of November 15th, 1980 was Deep Inside My Heart.
No,
by Randy Meisner.
Oh, yeah, from the Eagles, right?
Okay.
He used to be in the Eagles. Yeah, it's weird to think about the music that was a hit right before MTV started. Mm-hmm. And, like, you know, that's where a lot of my knowledge would have begun. Like, you talk about John Cougar. I never heard of him till Hurt So Good. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, like, 82, right? 82, 83, something like that. Like, Jack and Diane, so.
Yeah. All right, so that was November 15th. 2 weeks later, the weekend of November 29th, just after Thanksgiving probably, Turning Japanese peaks at number 36. Again, I thought this would have been much higher, but
yeah,
it was just at 36. But your top 10 for the weekend of November 29th, and I'm sure you'll get a couple of more. You'll get some of these. Now we get into the songs that, you know, have stood the test of time. Number 10 is Dreaming.
Dreaming?
Yes.
I was thinking Blondie, but no.
That's Cliff Richard.
Oh, okay.
Number 9, Not Poison. I'll give you that hint up front. It's Love on the Rocks.
Is that Neil Diamond?
That is Neil Diamond. Number 8 is Just Like Starting Over.
Oh, with John Lennon.
Yep. This would have been, what, a week and a half before his untimely passing?
Yeah, December, wasn't it? Something like that. Yeah. And that album, I think that album came out. I thought the album came out after he'd already died. He won all the Grammys.
I thought
stuff.
So, yeah. I'll never forgive Fat Jared Leto for shooting him.
Bastard.
Number 7 is Master Blaster.
Oh, Stevie Wonder?
Stevie Wonder, yeah. Number 6 is More Than I Can Say.
More Than I Can Say. I'm sure I'm going to be kicking myself, but go ahead.
That's Leo Sayer.
Okay. You made me feel like dancing, right? That was his big song.
I know the name, but I couldn't tell you anything by Leo Sayer. I should probably give him a shot sometime. Check him out.
I mean, we could have looked at, I could have done that as a one-hit wonder. I was thinking, but I always thought You Make Me Feel Like Dancing was his big hit. But yeah, okay.
Number 5 is I'm Coming Out.
No, there's Diana Ross. Yeah.
That's Diana Ross. Number 4 is Another One Bites the Dust.
Queen, the very first album I ever owned as a kid was the Queen Greatest Hits on vinyl. Yeah.
Number 3 is The Wanderer.
The Wanderer?
Yeah.
No.
Donna Summer.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Number 2 is Woman in Love.
Uh-oh. That's Barbara Streisand.
And
from there, I will say real quick, that's from her album Guilty, which is one of my favorite albums of all time. That is a Bee Gees album. With Barbara Streisand singing lead on all the tracks. Yeah, that's what it basically what it sounds like. It's the Bee Gees did all the producing and played the backing instruments and wrote the songs and stuff. But yeah, Woman in Love, Barbara Streisand, such a good song.
And then your number one song for the third week in a row, number one for the week of November 29th, 1980, is Lady. Lady.
I mean, Kenny Rogers?
Kenny Rogers, yes. The late, great Kenny Rogers.
And I love you. Yeah, that, okay.
So.
Well, I don't know. Did you see that, like, you were talking about how you thought it would have been a bigger hit. I thought it would have been bigger as well. I mean, you always think about them as being one-hit wonders. You usually don't think of one-hit wonders who only cracked 36. Like, you think they would be a little bit higher. I saw that, you know, it was top 10 in New Zealand and Ireland and Canada. It went to number 1 in Australia. And it peaked in the UK at number 3. And what was funny was... the song, you talk about how they didn't want to be lumped in too much with the Jam. Well, the single was produced by this, here's a great name for you, Vic Coopersmith Heaven. Not his real name. I looked up, I think his name is just Victor Smith, and he changed it. But he was the Jam's producer, and he produced the song. And when Turning Japanese hit number 3 on the UK charts, the Jam had a song called Going Underground, and that was number 1 on the charts at the same time. And so, I don't know if you... They were saying how, you know, the song was doing really well, but then remember how they were managed by the bass player and the manager of the Jam. Well, after Turning Japanese blew up, those guys, Bruce Foxton, John Weller, had to leave because they said it was too difficult to be with the Jam and the Vapors. There was a story about the Jam wanted to go tour in Europe and the Vapors got an offer to tour in America. And so the manager was like, I can't be in both places. And Bruce Foxton's like, I'm in the Jam. I have to go tour Europe. And so Dave Fenton talks about how, like, the song, right when the song blows up, all of a sudden, I don't have a manager anymore because it's it was too difficult for them to manage both bands, I guess. But yeah, no, it's interesting. Like, and I mean, Dave Fenton talks about how the whole thing with, is the song about masturbation. And that's something that I'm sure somewhere along the line, I may have heard that. I obviously would never would have realized that back in the 80s. Mm-hmm. Same as I never really realized Shebop was about masturbation. And then somewhere in the 90s, I think I might have overheard somebody say, oh yeah, it's about masturbation. And then somebody describes, oh, I guess you're supposed to, you squint when you climax. And you're just like, wait, what? And I mean, maybe it's easy, especially when you listen to the lyrics where he's talking about, you know, the lyrics are just one-sided, him talking about his love for this girl. It's like a post-breakup song, I guess. But at the same time, it's like, you know, Dave Fenton came out and said, no, it's not about that. It's just about this guy. It's the angst of teenage love. And I don't know, did you read that thing where he said it could have been Portuguese mm-hmm. or Lebanese?
Yeah, I've got that quote here.
Yeah, yeah, turning Portuguese. I think I'm turning Lebanese. I really think so. I mean, it could work. I mean, at that time, Lebanon would have been under a lot of war-torn strife, and there was a lot of bad stuff happening in Lebanon at the time. I don't know. But Portuguese? Yeah, I don't know. I mean, what's funny was, like, even if he says that that's what it is, I think he said something about, like, it's about a guy who wishes he was someone else, or he's just turning around, and this woman has put his world upside down, and he's turning into a completely another person. Mm-hmm. What I find so funny is it seems like the meaning of the song has been misappropriated over the years. Not just the whole masturbation angle, but like there's no reference to Japanese culture at all in the lyrics. Like, it has nothing to do with that. But yet, because it has that oriental riff in there, you hear the song used in like movies or TV shows where it has something to do with a Japanese person. And it's just like, oh, Japanese. Like, you know, we usually like to talk about like if there's famous cover versions of these songs. And I don't know, did you watch the music video of Kirsten Dunst does a cover of the song?
Yes, I did. And I had to, because I was searching on YouTube and I found that video and I'm like, is this real or is this someone pretending to be Kirsten? What is the, you know, the backstory here? And I did find citation that said that she recorded it for a video of the song for a 2009 exhibition in London called Pop Life, Art in a Material World.
Your picture of me and you. You wrote, I love you. I wrote, me too. I sit there staring, and there's nothing else to do. Oh, it's in color. Your hair is brown. Your eyes are hazel.
And the video was directed by
McGee, right?
McGee. Yes, the great director of Charlie's Angels and Terminator Salvation.
Well, and of course, Charlie's Angels is one of the many movies mm-hmm. that has featured the song Turning yeah. Japanese as well. Yeah. But, I mean, it's, like I said, the song has nothing to do with Japan itself, but yet, mm-hmm. you know, Kirsten Dunst does this video where she shot the video on location in Japan, and she's dressed like a little Japanese girl, mm-hmm. and it's sort of weird to think, like, okay, it's basically taken on a life of its own. Right, it means something completely different, but because he made it into a nationality, like if it would have been, you know, I'm turning round and round, I think I'm turning round and round, I really think so, you know, or something like that. Like, okay, that's maybe it's catchy, but it doesn't have like that some sort of nationality attached to it. Like, I mean, I think you talked about it on our last episode about Return of the Mac being like a little repetitive. I got to be honest with you, like the chorus mm-hmm. of Turning Japanese is an earworm, mm-hmm. but unfortunately it is very repetitive, and I think it's almost to the point of annoyance. Mm-hmm. And you know, we've done 30 some odd episodes of this show, and I think some of them have been great because I'm like, man, I cannot get enough of hearing She Blinded Me with Science. You know, I can't get enough of hearing Let's Go All the Way. Mm-hmm. But then I tell you, after about the second day of researching Turning Japanese, I'm like, okay, I'm good. I have heard this song enough times. And I say that as somebody who loves Liz Phair, and Liz Phair does an awesome cover version of this song as well, which I have in my iTunes. And I just like, I think I'm going to take a break from, I don't even want to listen to Liz Phair after we're done with this as well.
But. Yeah, I did see a lot of comments looking through different videos, like live versions and whatnot on YouTube. A lot of comments were, you know, saying like, this isn't even the band's best song. Like, there are so many better songs on the album. This one just seemed to hit. And I do think part of it is the oriental riff. It's because, you know, it already been proven successful with Carl Douglas.
Sure.
But, and I think that repetition does help because, I mean, that's a staple of pop music is to be repetitive. And I'm with you that I think it's a little too much. And I think that's, you know, maybe like the punk, if the band would have been more punk-ish of doing straight 2 minutes or 2.5 minute songs, this would have been better. But they, listening to a lot of their songs, they probably go on 30 seconds to a minute longer than need be.
And, yeah, that's fair.
But real quick, yeah. You know, we talked about it only reaching number 36, and you would expect it to be higher. I wanted to bring up the fact that the song I Melt With You by
Modern English
would not qualify for this series because it was never a top 40 hit. So,
really?
But it's, you know, ubiquitous amongst one hit wonder qualifications other than chart, you know, because everyone knows I Melt With You. So yeah, I guess that's just, you know, there's something for, you know, and we've also mentioned in the past about radio hits versus MTV hits. And like you said, if this would have came out when MTV was looking for videos, you know, MTV would have launched a year later, but if they didn't have a whole lot in their catalog to be playing, this probably got played every couple of hours and made it a bigger hit than you would have expected. So
yeah, and it doesn't quite, it's weird because like it's a decent song and it's catchy, but I wonder if it doesn't, you know, it's not necessarily gimmicky, but it has a little bit of a shtick to it that has probably lended itself to having such a life this many years later. Like, I really feel like, you know, it may not have charted as high as Too Shy, for example, but it's one of those ones that I think more people probably know. Mm-hmm. You know, 40 years later, people hear it and they're like, oh, yeah, I got your picture. I got, you know, like they know it versus something where if you hear the verses, you probably don't even know what song it is. Whereas I think if you hear the verses of Turning Japanese, you'll recognize it pretty quickly.
I agree with you. I think I think the music comes into play in that regard because I'm sitting here racking my brain trying to think of the lyrics of Too Shy and I got nothing.
Yeah.
But
all you know is the chorus, but you can think of, maybe it's because it's fresh in our mind, but you can easily, you know, even if we hadn't done this episode, you know, or if you come back in a year from now, I think you'll still be able to say, I got your picture. Like, you just know it. Because he says it multiple times in the song.
Well, I was going to say, even if I couldn't think of the lyrics to Turning Japanese, I can hear the beat in my head, whereas Too Shy, it's like the chorus is the only thing that I could, you know, if you started playing them and took the vocals out and said, you know, just name the song, I got nothing for Too Shy. But let's talk about the album.
I was going to say real quick before we go to the album. I always like to look at, like, something you mentioned, compilation albums.
Okay.
I looked for Turning Japanese. I counted 63 compilation albums, and it appears in several films. It's not necessarily on the soundtracks to all of them, but it appears, these are all the films that I found that it appears in. Okay. 16 Candles.
And let me guess, Angel. It was used in a scene with Long Duck Dong in a very inappropriate racist context.
I mean, I don't know 16 Candles very well. I think I saw it years after it came out, so I don't really remember where it's used. It's used in Charlie's Angels. I remember specifically, I think it's used in the scene where Lucy Liu is pretending to be like a geisha at one point. Yeah. It's in Jackass the Movie. It's in Let Me In. There's a movie called Rio Sex Comedy with Bill Pullman. I never heard of that one. A movie called The D-Train with Jack Black. I don't know that one. There's also a movie called Goal 2, Living the Dream, which is like this, it's a soccer sequel. But what I thought was pretty interesting is it appears in three different films that were released by Touchstone Pictures, which is the other podcast that Chad and I do called Out of Touchstone. It's in The Gun in Betty Lou's Handbag, and it's in two consecutive Touchstone Pictures that were released in 1997, which is The Sixth Man with Marlon Wayans. And also, of course, Romy and Michelle's high school reunion. And now I think I saw that it's only on the soundtrack of The D-Train, Charlie's Angels, and Romy and Michelle's high school reunion. But yeah, it's on several different movies. And then the last note I had on the song itself was Dave Fenton was talking about the bands of that era, and he mentioned Devo. And he said specifically, without Devo, he never would have written Turning Japanese. Like he mentions he's a big David Bowie fan. That's probably his biggest influence musically, especially if he had a folk upbringing, just like Bowie did. But he said that Devo was like the inspiration for that song. And now that you hear that, Chad, you probably can hear like a Devo sound to it, right?
I can see that. Although I have to admit that Devo, I only know from Whip It. I have not delved into the history of Devo.
You don't remember playing Uncontrollable Urge on Rock Band?
Nope.
And they also did that really awesome cover version of the Rolling Stones, I Can't Get No Satisfaction. But yeah, no, they've got, I think they do technically qualify as a one-hit wonder, you know, even though some of their other albums are better than the one that had Whip It on it. But yeah. So yeah, we can look at the album. Their first album was called, it's a pretty clever title. It's called New Clear Days. Sort of a pun on the word nuclear days and all about, you know, the nuclear proliferation and whatnot. I did see that the album itself made it all the way to number 62 on the album charts. But I think it's just a tight collection of songs. I think there was like a North American release, and then there was also a British release, and they updated the tracks and kind of updated them a little bit or rearranged them a little bit. But the album was a fun listen. I really did. I mean, some of the songs sounded a little bit alike. But it's I don't want to say disposable because it sounds like it's a bad thing, but it's just, you put it on in the background, it's kind of fun, and you move on to the next album. Like it's fine. I mean, what were your thoughts on the album? And then we can go into if there's any songs that stuck out for you.
No, I was pleasantly surprised by this album. And, you know, I have all their albums on my phone because I would listen to it as I was walking or driving, and they will probably stay on my phone. After last month's episode, as soon as we were done, Mark Morrison was deleted.
sure.
But no, and I've been racking my brain while listening again to the album before we recorded, like trying to think of what band, besides The Jam, probably, which I'm not that familiar with, but they have a sound that is very familiar to me, and I just can't place it. And I'm going to throw out a band name that I don't know how familiar you are with them, and I don't know if it's a good comparison, but what you have just said kind of put me in this direction is the band All, which is for the punk fans out there.
All. Okay.
So there was a band called The Descendants.
Yeah, I've heard of The Descendants. And I vaguely remember, I might have heard of All, yeah.
Okay, the lead singer of The Descendants, Milo, went off to college, and I believe their last album was called Milo Goes to College. And then they brought in another singer and changed the name to All. And so they're I guess for lack of a better term, power punk band that sings a lot about relationships, and their songs are, you know, 2-3 minutes long, and then you go right into the next one, and it's very, again, I don't want to copy your words, but with the same sentiment, it's not disposable in regards of just, you know, you easily forget it. It's just each song is very reminiscent. I've described All to friends as if the Ramones wrote love songs, that's what All is. So maybe there's some of that. And because I was just listening to an All's Greatest Hits mix CD that I burned several years ago, maybe I had that in the mind. But no, I when we switched from the Gentry's, I did listen to the Gentry's album, and it just sounded like kind of that 1960s pop sound. I'm like, okay, I think that would have been more disposable if we would have stuck with that. Yeah. But yeah, after I switched and I listened to this album, I was very happy with my choice to change. And like I said, I would highly recommend checking out The Vapors. And I actually had this playing in my car this past weekend when I went hiking, and I picked my friend up, and he's like, "Oh, who is this?" I'm like, "Oh, this is The Vapors." He's like, "Are they?" And I said, "You know, they had the hit with Turning Japanese." Like, "Oh, yeah, this sounds very 80s. And and then he was like, "No, this is really good. I like it." So, and that was actually their second album that I had playing. So,
I actually saw like a little bit of M. You know, like some of the, like, remember M's second album, the one that was like a little bit more darker, and you know, I thought that kind of reminded me of, like, I like a lot of 80s new wave stuff. I mean, I think like Duran Duran would have been a little bit more pop. And I mean, Devo was out there. I was a big fan of, I like Wall of Voodoo, which, I mean, their sound was not quite the same, but similar, kind of like that, those shorter post-punk type songs, new wave. But yeah, I mean, it was enjoyable enough. There was a particular song on there that I really, really enjoyed that was called Letter from Hero. Mm. And that was probably my favorite song on the album. I really also like the follow-up single after Turning Japanese was a song called News at 10. And I liked that one a lot. I thought that was a pretty decent single. I mean, and then I just listened to it again when I was making dinner tonight before we recorded, and it was like, yeah, it was kind of good. You know, the song when they're Waiting for the Weekend was like this really kind of fun, bubbly pop song. Yeah, a bubbly pop song kind of from a post-punk band.
Yeah.
Yeah, but like I said, it was enjoyable enough. It was fun to kind of discover some of the other stuff that they had done outside of the one song that people seem, that true fans of the Vapors will say, well, they're much... Like you said, they're more than just that one song. They sound better on the other songs. You know?
Yeah. So did you listen to the follow-up album?
I listened to several of the tracks from it. I thought it was a little more darker, more cynical, kind of had a political edge. I mean, I think they probably started, like, it seems like the meanings and the behind some of the songs on the first album were just like, oh, this was their reaction to war, or this was their reaction to punk music. Whereas the second album, I think it was like, they got even deeper politically, you know. Like, I think I saw that the first single on there was called Jimmy Jones, which was about Jim Jones and his cult and their mass suicide, even though that would have only been a couple of years old at the time. Yeah. So it was like, ooh, they're already doing songs about that? That was, yeah, like, I thought it was kind of easy to see why the second album didn't necessarily catch on, I guess.
Yeah, and I think Jimmy Jones is that repetitiveness that you were talking about with Turning Japanese. Like, it's just like, it's like, okay, we get it. Like, let's... So, yeah, I mean, I liked the second album, but I think the first two songs, Jimmy Jones and Spiders, should not have come at the beginning of the album. Like, move those down.
Oh, okay.
Get someone, you know, get invested into the album, then throw those songs out there. But but that album came out, I believe, in 1981, 82, somewhere. And then that's it. The Vapors are up in smoke, if you will.
Ah, there you go. They've evaporated.
Evaporated.
Right? Like, and what's so funny is we always talk about, like, how come these bands didn't catch on, or and, you know, I mean, we've done over 30 of these, and it seems like the most common theme is the one that sort of sunk the Vapors, or dissolved the Vapors, if you will. And that was just record label instability, right? Like, that seems to be, like, I read interviews with the other band members and also with Dave Fenton where, you know, he mentions how, I guess, when Turning Japanese hit big, Dave was like 26 and the other members of the band were all like 18 or 19. And so he mentions how, like, they wanted to party and be immature while Dave was a little bit more interested in the music. But again, it was the record label. I mentioned that United Artists Records was who the label they were on. But then that label was sold to EMI and renamed as Liberty Records. And many of the artists who were involved in the transfer from the one label to the other label already complained of poor management at the new company. Like, they didn't care. All the established artists, they had to downsize the label. And so a bunch of the bands that were maybe not performing as well or not as well known got kind of marginalized. I read this interview with Dave Fenton where he said that their follow-up single, News at 10, was released. The day that the single was released, he was at the Liberty Records office, and his A&R rep didn't even know it had come out. And he was saying how, like, you're supposed to know these things. This is our single. And they weren't even aware. And so the song News at 10, which, again, I thought it was a good enough song to be a second single, it probably should have been a hit. I read that it charted at number 44 on the UK charts, and that guaranteed them a performance on Top of the Pops. But at the exact same time, there was a strike at the BBC. And so Top of the Pops was, they weren't doing episodes. It was canceled for the moment. And he claims, because, like, he always says, it had nothing to do with the instability with the band. He said that the band members say how, like, if they had been more successful, they could have gotten past the age difference and the lifestyle difference. But the fact that the record label wasn't really helping them out, and that really dumb luck that they missed out on the chance to be on Top of the Pops because there was a strike at the BBC. You know, and so I was like, that's a little unfortunate. But I think it's something that we, I kind of maybe alluded to at the beginning, but I think on the whole, that's a weird time period. That 1980, 81. I mean, I think we discussed it probably when we talk about M. But you're kind of coming out of disco, right? You got the post-punk stuff. You got a little bit of heavy metal. And MTV hasn't quite taken off yet. And so I feel like the Vapors sort of fit into that time period, that very brief time period, because their time period was brief as well, where they're trying to kind of bridge the gap between that post-punk of the Jam and the early new wave of the MTV era. And I think in a way, like, they were too pop to be punk and too punk to be pop, right? Mm. You know, like it's hard to be popular in one genre when you're kind of like a hybrid of two. Like, the people in the new wave genre will be like, no, they're not really Duran Durani enough for us. And the people in the post-punk side will be like, well, they're not the Jam-ish, you know? And I think, but at the same time, like, they weren't really groundbreaking enough. Like, I could see if you're this groundbreaking artist and you can say, oh, I'm going to bridge these two styles together and then run with it, and then they blow up. But I just didn't think that the Vapors weren't strong enough to be the sort of trailblazers in that scene. Like, I could see why they were, unfortunately, one-hit wonders. The song that's the catchiest is the one that's the hit, but the other songs are kind of get dismissed. Yeah, and then that's more or less what happens to them. And they don't have a record label. They don't have a producer. You know, and one of those interviews I read with Dave Fenton, he said that, you know, the year that they hit big, he said everything that could have gone wrong went right. And then the next year, everything went wrong. Like, everything that could have gone wrong went wrong. And so it was just kind of dumb luck. And they all went their separate ways. And then Dave eventually went back into music law. But yeah. And so, I mean, like I said, it's a shame. It's another one of those ones where I'm glad we started this podcast for that reason, to chance to kind of hear some of those other songs. Mm-hmm. That I think, I mean, to be honest with you, and I'm sure that those fans of the Vapors say the same thing, I think that the other songs were a lot more enjoyable to me than Turning Japanese was.
Yeah, I mean, I like Turning Japanese, but I'm with you. I think, and probably because of being a one-hit wonder, I've heard Turning Japanese so much in the last 40 years that, like I said, when I go back to listening to the albums, I'll probably still listen to it if it comes up on like shuffle, but I would normally want to skip it and listen to everything else and become more familiar with that. But, you know, going back to the reason why they were a one-hit wonder, I'm looking at the full chart of when they hit the top 40, if you will. And there's just, you look at the music trend, and I mean, I'm surprised that You Shook Me All Night Long by AC/DC is on here at number 36, but you know, you got the theme from Dukes of Hazzard cracking the top 10.
I had that on 45 when I was a kid. Yeah.
I mean, but yeah, it's just, there's nothing like them in the charts. And so, you know, we've said it before where that can be a good thing if, you know, if it makes you stand apart, or it can be a bad thing, like in the 90s when all the one-hit wonders that we've discussed had the one hit because they sounded nothing like what was popular, and mm-hmm. they just had that one hit that did kind of cross over, and did.
But is it a talent thing sometimes, I wonder? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't want to diminish the talents of any of these artists, but I always wonder, like, is it just maybe the songwriting wasn't quite strong enough? Or, like, I mean, if you look at, okay, for example, let's look at The Police. Mm-hmm. Their first album would have been 1978. They were kind of doing post-punk. Like, their first album sounds, their first, actually, you know what? If you like the Vapors, Chad, you should listen to The Police's first mm-hmm. album. You know, I mean, I know everyone's heard Roxanne, but then when you listen to the other stuff on that, it sounds a little bit like the Vapors do. And you got, and now you got Sting singing. But then they also were able to blend like reggae influences into it. And, you know, I talk about like, could you blend genres if you're strong enough? Well, they were strong enough, I think. They were good enough songwriters and musicians, and Sting was a good enough vocalist that they could take that post-punk sound that the Jam and them were doing and then basically be like, we're going to have fun with it, rather than being aggressive and angry at the government and make politically themed songs. We're going to write love songs, or we're just going to write songs about partying, and we're going to have, just like I said, some reggae influences. Stuart Copeland is still one of my favorite drummers of all time. you know. And I think by 1980, the Police would have had three records out. They would have been fairly popular. That was the same year. 1980 was the same year they released Don't Stand So Close to Me. And so that was, that's kind of got a similar sound. I mean, in the sense that I could see those all being on the charts at the same time. But yeah, no, I mean, it's funny to think about, like, they break up and then they finally, well, if you want to get into it, we could talk about their reunions. Yeah. Like, they had these reunions in the mid-2010s where it was, I think it was like three of the four guys got back together and then they had a new drummer. And, you know, they did that thing where they played some of the flashback tours. Mm-hmm. And they were, and I think we talked about that, like, oh, some of these bands would play these throwback tours, but they were complaining because they're just like, oh, you just get to do three or four songs. Like, do you really get a chance to kind of go deeper into your catalog? But at the same time, you're like, well, I'm glad that people want to hear these, people want to hear Turning Japanese, and it's maybe it gives you a chance to sort of open up to a new audience. But, I guess by the time 2019 rolls around, I thought this was absolutely fascinating. But again, I said I was a big fan of The Jam. For whatever reason, and I'm sure he has his reasons, Paul Weller broke up The Jam and refuses to get back together. He is just a true artiste. Like, he's like, that's behind me. That's 40 years ago. That's behind me. Like, my hope is that if they ever were to get inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, maybe that might force them to get back together, because the other two guys from The Jam wound up forming a group that was called From the Jam. Now, I believe the drummer is not in it anymore, but there's that bass player, Bruce Foxton, and it's him and a guitar player, and the Jam is a three-piece band. And so it's Bruce Foxton and a new guitar player and a new drummer. And in April of 2019, From the Jam said, we're going to go on a tour for the 40th anniversary of the Setting Suns album. And so they invited the Vapors to open for them. And I think that's really cool. That's some really cool synergy for them to come back. And now the Vapors were more or less reunited. Yeah. And I did see also in 2019, did you see that there was a Vapors convention? It was held in Wales. And it was held in a resort where they filmed the TV show The Prisoner. And they said there was just a bunch of Vapors fans there. And they got to play on this stage for all these Vapors fans. You're like, wow, that's kind of neat. And then, after years of kind of, I don't say threatening to do it, they released a comeback album. It was called Together, mm-hmm. and it came out after the pandemic started in 2020. And I was reading on the Wikipedia page, and it said they went 39 years between albums. You know, that their second album was called Magnets. It was 1981, like you said, Chad. And then Together was 2020, 39 years between albums. I mean, I was fascinated to see that there was like 10 more bands that have had even longer gaps. But yeah, and you listen to it. Yeah. I listened to it a couple of hours ago. It's a little bit more polished, right? It sounds like more polished pop, and you know. But at the same time, you can really tell that the lead singer's in his mid 60s, right?
Yeah. No, I was listening to it right before we started recording, and I'm enjoying the album. And I think what is good is that they didn't try to shift who they were to fit into today. That may not sound like a good thing, but they stay true to what the Vapors were, instead of trying to be like, okay, we're coming back, let's see what's popular now, and you know, adjust our sound to try to get more play. And you know, I was thinking about it, because we always ask, you know, would you go see this band if they were touring? And I'm kind of with them. I don't want to see them on a 80s flashback tour, because you're probably only going to get Turning Japanese and one other song. And I would rather hear everything else from the album. I want the deep album cuts. And I saw that they do have tour dates lined up for 2021, assuming that everything is back together, but it's only in Europe. And
I'd imagine the British bands probably only be able to play over there, most likely. Yeah.
And I'm just like, you know, if we're allowed to travel, depending on what's going on, would I be, you know, motivated to go to Europe and schedule it around a time when I might be able to see them? The way things have gone in 2020, absolutely. I would.
Sure.
I would go. And so, I don't know if they will ever make it over to the States again. And like you said, the age of the lead singer may have something to do with that. I saw some videos from like 2018, 2019 of them playing, and they, you know.
They still got it.
Yeah, they still got it. So we'll see. Yeah. But yeah, I I found it interesting. Again, just luck that we switched to this band, and they put out an album 3 months ago, 4 months ago. So
yeah, it's fun. Like I was going to say, like, I mean, the new album was enjoyable enough. It kind of reminds me of, you know, back in the 60s, you're familiar with the band The Kinks, right? Mm-hmm. You know, so they would have done, you know, All Day and All the Night, You Really Got Me. And then the 1980s, they came out and they did that song Come Dancing. And it was like totally different. It was like you could tell it was still the same band, but the singer's voice sounded a little bit. He's a little older. The song was a little more polished. And it wasn't as that aggressive rock music. And it kind of reminded me. The Vapors 2020 album reminded me of when the Kinks came back in the 80s. You know, and I saw that the first two songs on the album were both released as singles, but neither of them charted. You know, and it did, but it definitely reeked of what I would call a comeback album. You know, and with all due respect to that new album, I feel like it's the kind of songs that if you saw the band live, and they said we're gonna play something off this album, that's when you maybe might go grab a drink. You know, well, you can still hear it, but you're like, I'm gonna sneak out and grab a drink, so I'm in back in time for them to do News at 10 or Jimmy Jones or something like that. But yeah, no, it's kind of interesting in that regard. That I'm kind of glad that they're still back together. And it's interesting, if they're just going to play in England, yeah, like you're right, could we go travel over there? There is another British band from the 21st century that I love called the Futureheads. And I think that they're one of those bands that sounds like if you took the Jam and the Vapors and those 80s post-punk bands and made a 21st century version of them, where they're quick songs, they're kind of aggressive, but they're not, you know, it's not going to put you off. You know, I would recommend, if you're interested to hear like what the Vapors would have sounded like if they'd have come out in 2010 or something, I would recommend the Futureheads. That'd be a good tour. Have the sort of like a blast from the past. Have the one of them open for the other, and then yeah, they can be kind of fun. But before I forget, the last note I have on this, I want to make sure I mention this, was the lead guitar player of the band is a guy named Ed Bazalgette. And after the band broke up, I mentioned Dave Fenton went back into music law, worked in that industry for years. Ed Bazalgette went on to a successful career doing British television. He started out as an editor, then he went into producing and directing. He's directed a bunch of different popular British TV series, including Doctor Who. He did two episodes of Doctor Who in season 9, which would have been the 12th Doctor, Peter Capaldi. And he also did one of the Christmas specials. He did a really good Doctor Who Christmas special, which is called The Return of Dr. Mysterio, which, oh, it's such a great episode. I wasn't sure. Chad, did you say that you watched the TV show Shameless?
I've watched the American version and like half of the first episode of the British version.
Okay. Well, there's an actor that's on that show. His name is Justin Chatwin. And he was in that Doctor Who episode, The Return of Dr. Mysterio. It's a really good one. But I don't really have a whole lot else. I got a really great quote to drop in the end. Is there anything else that you had in your notes?
No, and we're getting to the end of the show, so I was just going to say final thoughts on the Vapors. For me, it's a definite plus of why we do this show. It's a great find. Yeah. I highly recommend checking them out. Mike, what's your final verdict?
Same thing. I would say check out that album. I would say check out the Liz Phair version of Turning Japanese. And I would definitely say check out the Futureheads and the Jam. But that's only if you're in the mood to kind of venture out. But this quote, I got a quote from Dave Fenton. I want to make sure that I put this in here at the end of the episode. And he talks about maybe that's why they were one-hit wonder or not. And this is from Dave. He says, quote, "We did better abroad than we did at home, which meant we spent a lot of time away from the UK living out of suitcases. We spent a year or so chasing that one hit around the world. There was a lot of pressure there. I had to write another song as good as Turning Japanese to maintain our success, but there was no time as we were touring constantly," end quote. So yeah, that would explain it. They burned bright and they fizzled out, unfortunately, because it was just the way the music industry is sometimes, right?
Yeah, you can't. There is no recipe for success.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. So that's going to do it for this month. That's the Vapors. I'll say one last comment until after you give us the selection for next month, which, barring any changes, what are we going to be discussing for the month of November 2020?
Okay. I always like to look at, you know, when we started this show, we always have to try to figure out, like, okay, at what point is your status as a one-hit wonder cemented? Like, how much time has to go by? Is there a moratorium? Is there sort of a statute of limitations? Like, mm-hmm. how long until you say, okay, they're done, they're a one-hit wonder? Chad, would you think 10 years is a fair amount?
You know, it all comes down to if the person is still performing on a regular basis, you like, okay, there's still time. So I think you're a one-hit wonder until you're not a one-hit wonder.
Okay, well, I'm going to go ahead and say I specifically chose this song because it came out just over 10 years ago. We always talk about, can we have a 21st century one-hit wonder? We had Saving Jane, right? I think there's some other ones out there. And it seems like with musical taste changing and the way the charts are done, it feels like it's going to be hard for a band who had a hit 10 years ago to have another one. I hope I'm wrong, but until then, next month, Chad, we are going to discuss Pumped Up Kicks by Foster the People.
Okay.
Because I was trying to think about possible suggestions for 21st century bands. I'm like, okay, there's a good one. I don't know anything else about that band other than that one song. And when I looked at it about a year ago, I was like, well, the song came out in the fall of 2010. And so I'm like, all right, I'll give them a chance. I think they still had some recent albums that nothing's charting. And so I'm like, okay, it's been 10 years. Again, maybe we can curse them with good luck.
I thought you were going to go with, being that it's November, I thought you were going to go with Rebecca Black and Friday so we could tie it into Black Friday. And
No. Gimmicks, we said.
Yeah, which I will say, she did release an album either earlier this year or last year. Non-ironically, check it out because she has grown as a performer. So, yeah, I know nothing about Foster the People, so looking forward to checking this out. And that's going to do it for this month. Real quick, just to put some final bows, the footnotes to some of the stuff we talked about earlier. When the Turning Japanese was on the American charts, so was Whip It by Devo. It was in the teens. And, you know, going back to their comment that it could have been Turning Lebanese, Turning Portuguese. You know who's from Portugal? No. Nuno Betancourt, the guitar player for Extreme.
Ah, you worked it in.
I had to get it in right at the end. So that's going to do it for this edition of Wonder Why. Again, Mike and I do another podcast. It's called Out of Touchstone. You can find it wherever you listen to podcasts. That's the word I was looking for. It's a podcast. So check it out. It's on Twitter at Out of Touchstone. Mike is on Twitter at Mike DeKalb. I'm on Twitter at Chad Smart. Very simple, easy to find us. If you love us, if you hate us, if you're very indifferent, just send us some tweets. We need some entertainment during the day. Until then, as always, question everything, do something positive.
You're listening to a Positive Cynicism podcast presentation. For more information, check out positivecynicism.com.